Jawad's father, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rida alayhi salam, himself had undertaken the upbringing, the nurturing, the education of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And so we find that Imam al-Rida alayhi salam took Imam al-Jawad with him wherever he went and fed him with his own hands. A divinely appointed Imam, nurtured and educated by a divinely appointed Imam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, the ninth divinely appointed Imam, of course, is the Imam who was selected divinely by the previous Imam, the eighth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rida alayhi salam. Now, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was contemporary with the Abbasid caliphs, and we find that the Abbasid caliphs had this immoral and quite decadent way of living. Now, as far as their decadence is concerned, we find that the amount of moral and societal, governmental, financial corruption which was happening was truly something that was unprecedented. The more that time continued forwards, the more this moral decadence seemed to be increasing. Now, of course, as we have said in one of our previous programs, that according to the Ahlul Bayt, the people are upon the religion of their rulers. So if the rulers happen to be people who are mean or who are cruel or who have hard hearts or they are people who do not have any liking or yearning towards religion and deen and faith, well, the rest of the people will be in a similar fashion. Now, when talking about these kind of moral excellencies in order to combat the moral decadence that was prevalent during his era, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam talks about three things. And he says, these are three things that whoever has them, they will have no regret. Now, in the previous program, we talked about one of those three things, which was to avoid hastiness. Now, the second thing was to consult with others. Now, of course, it might seem like something that is quite blatant and it might seem like it's common sense. But dear friends, a lot of people don't even have this common sense. Of course, we are requested and we are advised by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that we should consult with others before making decisions. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean minor decisions, because we won't be able to consult with others in every single minor decision of ours. In the end, we will have to make our own decisions. But when it comes to major decisions, and even though materialistic decisions are not necessarily the ultimate decisions that we are going to be making, but of course they are a part of our everyday life. So for example, if you're going to buy a house or you're going to buy a car, then of course you should consult with each other, with other people. And who do you consult with? Well, you consult with people that are intellectuals, that are academics, but more so those people that are religious. Because as we have seen, a religious person will give you the point of view of religion. So when going to consult another person in this aspect that they are a representative of the religion, don't go to a normal person. Go to a scholar, and then go to a trusted scholar more so, a scholar which is a righteous scholar, a scholar who follows what they say and they follow the tenets of Islam and they apply what they have as knowledge into action. And so, of course, it is common sense now that after you consult with others regarding these important and large things that are decisions, excuse me, that we are to make in our life, of course, we will have more information at hand. And with more information, more knowledge, and more wisdom, of course, we will be able to make a better decision, inshallah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarah Text of Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ayyuha an-nur as-safi. As-salamu alayka ayyuha al-badr al-tali.
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
EU is facing diesel crisis with Russian ban looming. According to ship tracking data, the bloc still relies on Moscow for 40% of imports. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, "The EU will have a difficult time replacing Russian diesel when a ban on the country's seaborne oil products and an accompanying price cap come into force on February 5th, Bloomberg reported recently. According to Bloomberg, citing ship tracking data from Vortexa, the EU imported about 220 million barrels of diesel-type product from Russia in 2022. By December, some 40% of the fuel came to the bloc from the sanctioned country. While the region's reliance on Russian petroleum products was reduced last year, in 2021, more than half of all seaborne shipments into the EU and UK were Russian, further illustrating the difficulty of replacing the barrels, which will fall under the ban in less than 3 weeks. Mark Williams, a Wood Mackenzie consultancy, told the news outlet, "There is a total rejigging in terms of diesel trade flows from the start of February." Data showed that the EU has already started to boost diesel shipments from Saudi Arabia and India. Analysts say that these shipments may be further increased this year through a number of new oil refineries that are soon to come online. Experts also point to the US as having the potential to deliver more diesel to the bloc. Furthermore, China may indirectly aid the region in acquiring diesel supplies. The country's diesel-type fuel exports are forecast to be similar in volume to what the EU and UK used to receive from Russia prior to sanctions. While those shipments do not usually end up in Europe, they could replace volumes from other producers, which would then be free to supply their fuel to the region. Williams told Bloomberg, "China policy is the game changer," adding, "That holds the key to all of the surplus refining capacity globally." The EU could also use intermediary countries to get the fuel. Turkey, not being a member state and thus not party to sanctions against Moscow, could raise imports of Russian diesel and sell it to the bloc after refining, which is allowed under the terms of the ban and price cap. However, the final cost of the fuel may be much higher in that case. Experts warn that sanctions may result in Russian barrels disappearing from the global market altogether if the country fails to find new non-EU buyers. This would force Moscow to slash production and consequently lower overall supply and drive up prices. Coupled with high demand, this could lead to a worsening of the energy crisis in the EU bloc. Hedi Grati from S&P Global told Bloomberg, "The higher the demand and the steeper Russian diesel production decline, the more complicated and potentially fractured things could get." Meanwhile, Reuters reported in this way, saying Europe is set to ban imports of Russian oil products on February 5th in a move that is already causing massive shifts in global diesel trading. Buyers are rushing to fill European oil storage tanks with Russian diesel, with flows this month on track to hit a one-year high. The European Union banned seaborne Russian crude imports from December 5th and will ban Russian oil products from February 5th. The group of seven nations, G7, Australia, and the 27 European Union countries also implemented on December 5th a price cap on Russian crude. This allowed non-EU countries to continue importing seaborne Russian crude oil, but it will prohibit shipping, insurance, and reinsurance companies from handling cargoes of Russian crude around the globe unless it is sold for less than $60. Russian Urals crude prices fell in December. Russian crude was sold to countries such as India well below the $60 per barrel price cap, according to trading sources, despite Russia saying it would not abide by the cap, even if it has to cut production.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws concerning the different types of water according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini. The son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
SubhanAllah.
back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, we talked about, the different types of water in the previous episode. And you barely started talking about cold water, but we couldn't afford the time, actually, to get into the Islamic laws regarding the cold water. Would you be able, or would you be kind enough, actually, to, shed some light on the Islamic laws, the rules about cold water for our dear audience?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we are talking about cold and little water, of course, we need to understand that they are basically different. Of course, little water is a small quantity of water, which if it comes to in contact with urine, with blood, or any essentially impure things, then it becomes impure, even if its color or taste or taste, the color, and the smell do not change. Mm-hmm. So that is little water. And of course, cool water is different. Cool water does not become impure. For example, if essential najasa or something which is, essentially impure comes, like, for example, like urine, like blood, or anything which has, become najis, for example, like a najis piece of cloth, falls into the cool water. And if the water acquires the smell, color, or taste of that najasa, then obviously it becomes najis. Or impure. But if it does not acquire the smell and the chain, and the color is not changed, and of course the taste of the water does not change, then obviously it does not become najis, and so it is treated as pure.
I see.
And this is the difference between little and cool water.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if the smell, color, or taste of cool water changes because of something else, like which is not najis essentially, then it does not become najis. So we are talking about cool water in the context of something najis coming into contact with cool water.
Yes, true.
Which becomes najis if the smell or color or taste of the water changes.
Regarding qalil water, one of the earlier examples of the type of water you gave, especially in the previous episode, I have a question regarding that. Let's focus on that question. If the lower part, Sheikh, the lower part of this qalil water that flows downward without pressure, of course, coming into contact with, a najis substance.
Yes.
All right. Will its upper part of the qalil water, whatever the quantity is, remain pure?
Yes, there's something else. Of course, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, the upper part of the, of the water will be pure, because it flows downward. And of course, the upper part will be and will remain pure if the water can be said to be flowing from a higher plane to a lower one, from a higher altitude to a lower one.
Right.
Okay, because they are separated from each other. There is some quantity of water. Little though the water is little, it's qalil, but nevertheless, because it's coming down or flowing from a higher place to a lower place, then that water which remains up there, it remains impure, and the water
remains pure.
Yeah, the water which is in the higher place, because that water which is in the lower place, it comes in contact with najis.
So
the two water, the water, they are the same, of course, but the water in the lower and at the bottom of the altitude becomes impure, and that water which is remains in the higher place does not become impure.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
Mm-hmm. followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid is still our guest speaker. We are talking about different types of water and their pertinent rules or Islamic laws. Well, Sheikh Javid, before me asking you a question regarding both core and running water, let's talk about some of the Islamic laws about the running water. Do we have the same rules, for the running water or apply to the core water true with the running water?
Of course, there is a slight difference between cool water and running water.
Uh-huh.
Running water, if its color or taste or, smell changes, only that part of the water whose color changes becomes impure. Now, the water which is added to that, and the water which is which flows down the stream and is not it has not changed, you see, does not become impure. Only that part of the water which comes in with something like urine, uh-huh, in contact with urine or blood or something, that part of the water which changes becomes impure, and then the remaining water is pure. Unlike cool water,
uh-huh,
which becomes impure,
yes,
if its color,
mm-hmm,
or taste or smell,
right,
changes, because it is, it is cool, it is collected, mm-hmm, in one place. Like, for example, imagine a tanker,
yes,
a tanker,
mm-hmm,
it is full of water, but its color is either red with blood, or it is, polluted, mm-hmm, with urine or something, and the taste is different from natural water. So, obviously, it is impure and it cannot purify anything.
But even that part, that amount of the running water, which takes the smell or color of, the najis substance.
Yes.
The impure substance. Even that part, that amount, for example, in the river that we call running water.
Yes.
If it stays in the current, if it is moving, if it is flowing, with the stream, then it becomes diluted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even that part of which we consider impure, doesn't it get pure? Doesn't it become pure?
In common view, if it is diluted to such an extent that it's not possible to distinguish,
mm-hmm,
whether the water, the taste of the water has changed or not, or the smell has changed, because, mm-hmm, it becomes so diluted that it's,
right,
not possible to distinguish. So you're not to blame.
Mm-hmm.
You can consider it as pure water, because,
yes,
that is the general principle, mm-hmm, applies to it.
Yes.
There is nothing to tell you that it is actually contaminated or polluted with urine or something. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You can use it as a purifying agent.
Yes. There's a quick question. We don't have much time, Sheikh Javid. If you want to purify najis clothes, all right?
Yes.
In cold water, or even if in running water.
Sure.
Is it necessary to wring them out, or after even removing the najis substance, is permeation enough?
Well, according to His Eminence, it's better to exercise precaution.
Mm-hmm.
And precaution means that one should actually wring the clothes out and make sure that there is no water left in the cloth. So wringing is good, it's better, and the precaution requires that one and do wring the cloth to make sure that there's no water left in the cloth.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers to these questions regarding different types of water and their Islamic laws according to the fatwas made by or decreed by Ayatollah Khamenei in this program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. We say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has recently announced his plan to create a regional bloc with close ties to Russia and China. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has proposed establishing a new international bloc involving Latin American and Caribbean countries that would have close ties to Russia and China. During his annual speech at Venezuela's parliament recently, Maduro said that he had recently spoken with the presidents of Brazil, Colombia, and Argentina about forming a new regional organization. According to Maduro, the time has come to unite efforts and paths in Latin America and the Caribbean to advance in the formation of a powerful bloc of political forces of economic power that speaks to the world. The Venezuelan president went on to say that the bloc would create new poles of power and would be allied to Russia and China, the leaders of which Maduro referred to as elder brothers. Such an alliance would compromise that community of shared destiny that our elder brother President Xi Jinping talks about, or that multipolar and multicentric world that our elder brother President Vladimir Putin talks about, Maduro said. He stressed for this world to arrive, a united and advanced Latin American and Caribbean bloc is needed. President Putin has repeatedly blasted the concept of a unipolar world dominated by the U.S. In September, he claimed that attempts to achieve such a configuration have taken an absolutely ugly form. Meanwhile, Beijing has also said that China and Russia are promoting together the multipolar world and do not recognize unipolar hegemony. Under former President Donald Trump, the U.S. regime denounced Venezuela's 2018 election, which Maduro won to secure a second term, as he claimed as illegitimate. Washington unleashed the maximum pressure campaign to oust him by imposing harsh sanctions on Caracas, which included an oil embargo. The U.S. regime also offered support to opposition leader Juan Guaido, recognizing him as Venezuela's interim president in 2019. In the aftermath of the move, Maduro's government broke off diplomatic relations with Washington. Since then, however, attempts to remove Maduro from power, which included a series of street protests and an outright coup attempt, fizzled out. In late December, opposition lawmakers in Venezuela voted to dissolve the interim government led by Guaido. While the U.S. regime still does not formally recognize Maduro, it has engaged in diplomatic contacts with Caracas in order to negotiate prisoner swaps and has lifted some sanctions. Also, Al Mayadin website noted Maduro underlined during his annual speech at the Venezuelan parliament that he recently spoke with Brazilian President Lula da Silva, Colombian President Gustavo Petro, and Argentine President Alberto Fernandez about forming a new regional organization in this regard. The time has come to unite efforts and paths in Latin America and the Caribbean to advance in the formation of a powerful bloc of political forces of economic power that speaks to the world, Maduro underlined. According to Maduro, the new bloc in question would contribute to the creation of a new poles of power and would be allied with Russia and China. The alliance that the Venezuelan president is talking about would comprise that community of shared destiny that our elder brother, Chinese President Xi Jinping, talks about, or the multipolar and multicentric world that our elder brother, Russian President Vladimir Putin, talks about, he explained. Al Mayadin also reported for the roles that the Chinese and Russian leaders are talking about to be realized, it is necessary for there to be a united and advanced Latin American and Caribbean bloc, Maduro said. Putin has on several occasions lambasted the U.S.-dominated unipolar world, explaining back in September that all the attempts to arrive at this end result have taken an absolutely ugly form. Putin criticized in September the Western attempts to create a unipolar world. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Ministry said recently that Washington's farce regarding Venezuela's opposition is to maintain control over the Latin American country's resources. The Venezuelan opposition voted out in late December the head of the interim government, Juan Guaido, the U.S.-sponsored, self-proclaimed interim president. The Venezuelan opposition Congress later on January 5th replaced Guaido and announced the appointment of Dinora Figuera as president and Fernandez and Vasquez as vice presidents for 2023 and 2024 legislative period. It is obvious that the tasks of the patrons of the color revolution that did not take place in Venezuela remain the same. The ultimate goal of this farce is not hidden, to keep control over the Venezuelan state, financial resources in foreign jurisdiction, the Russian ministry stated.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
مقایسه گاهی سعودی است گاهی نزولی است و گاهی همسط.
Dear brothers and sisters, we have three types of comparison. They are called ascending, descending, and parallel. Now, ascending comparison in financial matters might cause anxiety and unrest for a person, whereas in descending comparison can cause internal peace for someone. As it is related by Salman al-Farsi, who narrated from Prophet Muhammad, stating, O Salman, try to have a descending comparison in your worldly affairs. This statement by Prophet Muhammad means that we never compare our financial affairs with people who are higher than us, because we might not be able to reach them and become anxious and sometimes jealous inside.
سوره قصص آیه 79 خوب دقت کنید.
In Surah Qasas, Ayah 79, we read, So he emerged before his people in his finery. Those who desired the life of the world said, We wish we had like what Korah has been given. Indeed, he is greatly fortunate. Based on this ayah, the lovers of this world made an ascending comparison between themselves and Korah, and wished to be as fortunate as Korah was in terms of wealth. This is why they felt unfortunate about themselves, since their comparison was based on worldly desires. Therefore, comparing oneself with a person who is richer and wealthier than you only causes unrest inside your soul. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister Etmar Ben-Gvir, who has ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gvir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it, and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely. In office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said a move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gvir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during a Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about: the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty. And in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade. The United States, and yet again, racially motivated killings happening on a record number. The tragic death of Keenan Darren Anderson after he was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident has sparked outrage. Anderson, 31, cousin of the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, died at a hospital in Santa Monica, California, after suffering a cardiac arrest following the crash on the afternoon of January 3rd in a Los Angeles neighborhood. Anderson was repeatedly tased by Los Angeles police officers and restrained following the accident. In a 13-minute body cam footage released by Los Angeles Police Department, Anderson is seen begging for help as multiple officers hold him to the ground and one officer presses his elbow along with his body weight onto his neck.
You're trying to just
stop it. Stop it, I'm gonna tase you. Okay, stop it, I'm gonna tase you. Stop it, I'm gonna tase you.
Then Anderson can be heard, "They're trying to George Floyd me," referring to African-American man George Floyd, who was killed at the hands of the U.S. police in May 2020 in Minneapolis, sparking racial justice protests around the world. In the footage, Anderson shouts, "They're trying to kill me," asking others for help. After the incident, paramedics arrived at the scene and took him to a hospital, where according to the police, he went into cardiac arrest, which caused his death. Now, Patrice Cullors, who herself co-founded the Black Lives Matter movement, says her cousin was asking for help and he didn't receive it. She said he was killed, adding that nobody deserves to die in fear, panicking and scared for their life. Cullors noted her cousin was scared for his life, stressing that he spent the last 10 years witnessing a movement challenging the killing of black people. He knew what was at stake and he was trying to protect himself. Nobody was willing to protect him. Anderson's killing is the third such incident linked to the Los Angeles police in the first days of 2023. On January 2nd, police fatally shot 45-year-old Tucker Smith, and a day after, police fired on a 35-year-old Oscar Sanchez. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has called the incidents deeply disturbing, adding that we must reduce the use of force overall, and I have absolutely no tolerance for excessive force. The latest police violence highlights alarming proportions in the U.S. in recent years, with people of color being the main targets. A 2021 study recorded 30,800 deaths from the police violence across the U.S. between 1980 and 2018, far higher than estimates offered by the National Vital Statistics System. The study said more than 55 deaths of such incidents in the U.S. from 1980 to 2018 were misclassified or unreported in official vital statistics reports. Meanwhile, according to new data released earlier this month, U.S. police killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the country since experts first started tracking the killings. The killing of Kenan Darnell Anderson takes numerous matters into the spotlight. First and foremost is how U.S. officials reacted to the incident. 31-year-old father and English teacher, who is an African-American, killed by LAPD police. The cause, cardiac arrest after being repeatedly tased by the police. Anderson is the cousin of Black Lives Matter movement Patrice Cullors, but still no major word or reaction from anyone within the establishment. Two, could this death by any means be prevented? Cullors say this was a traffic accident. Instead of treating Anderson like a potential criminal, police could have called the ambulance. If there was a policy in which traffic stops were met with unarmed professionals who come to the scene to help with whatever situation has happened, that would have prevented my cousin's death. And that would have prevented so many other deaths. The other matter that has to be taken into account is how he was killed. One officer had his elbow on Anderson's neck while he was lying down before another tased him for roughly 30 seconds straight before pausing and tasing him again for 5 more seconds. The other point is LAPD not calling it a killing. It instead calls it an in-custody death. Apart from the ambiguity of the phrase, Keen was tased to death. Everyone knows LAPD caused Keenan's death. Cullors say these types of killing and this type of force will not be interrupted unless we have courageous elected officials come forward and challenge not just the police, but also the policies. One other factor is that the incident marked the third officer-involved death in the city this year. From 1980 to 2018, more than 30,000 people have died by police violence in the United States, according to a 22 article published in The Lancet. U.S. police killing 3 people in a day, and no progress since George Floyd. Based on figures released by Mapping Police Violence, police have killed roughly 1,100 people each year since 2013. In 2021, officers killed 1,136 people, one of the deadliest years on record. National data has shown that roughly 10% of the killings by police each year starts with a traffic encounter, and that 1 in 3 people killed were fleeing before lethal force was used. What about police brutality and racial bias? Why are there more cases of police brutality against African Americans or people of color than whites? By one estimate, black people are 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. In another study, black people who were fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Based on information from more than 2 million 911 calls in 2 U.S. cities, it can be concluded that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fired their guns 5 times as often as black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhoods. The Washington Post reports lawsuits to settle allegations of misconduct by more than 7,600 officers from around the country have amounted to more than $3.2 billion over the past decade. All in all, what seems to be a very high urgency is that U.S. police treatment of African Americans needs an overhaul. If not, more and more people like Kenan Darnell Anderson will fall victim to the U.S. police brutality, and officers involved killing will be sharply on the rise.
The Oxfam report analyzed 1,727 attacks on Yemeni civilians since the start of 2021. The report finds that at least 839 civilians were killed and 1,775 others were wounded during this time. 87 of the deaths were caused by airstrikes alone. The aircrafts used in the attacks, over half of them British-made, used cluster bombs, the use of which is banned by international law. The rest of the killings were done through artillery strikes, missile barrages, drone attacks, landmines, road bombs, and the use of light arms. According to another report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day on the war to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircrafts, Paveway bombs and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crime.